now more than ever, people need to go within and plug into that cellular memory, plug into divine source, detach as much as possible from the matrix. A lot of these people that have all these abilities, who have celestial star ancestry, they're operating not only throughout this cosmos, but in higher planes, and they're working against the Draco Empire. The photonic energy and the cosmic rays will activate our higher centers. And it's incumbent upon us to ride that frequency wave. Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you are listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, my very special guest is Lotta Ray. Lotta Ray is a geopolitical analyst, a future trends forecaster, a quantum metaphysical researcher, and consciousness expert. We are bringing her back rather quickly because of the current geopolitical situation. There is no one better to have on the Cosmic Switchboard Show to talk about the dynamics between Russia and the West than Lotta Ray. So without any further ado, Lotta Ray, how are you?
Pretty good. How are you, James?
I'm doing fine, Lotta. Thank you for coming on such short notice. At the outset, is there anything that you wanted to bring to the attention of your listeners and the listeners of the Cosmic Switchboard?
Thank you. As we discussed, I actually have two new Earthshift reports that just came out or are coming out, depending on when the show is actually aired. The first one is called Earthshift Report 15, and it's about the Putin's ultimatum to the U.S. We will discuss a lot of interesting and groundbreaking events. Putin's ultimatum refers to the plutonium ultimatum. And that's a story in itself. If we have time, we can go into that a little bit later. Plus, we will be discussing about the new breakthrough situation with Turkey. Russia and Turkey did sign the agreement on Turkish stream. So a lot of stuff is developing. U.S. has been shunned at the global summit for energy that just took place in Turkey, was not invited. Lots of things are happening geopolitically. It's an extremely volatile situation also that some are describing as the new Cold War. Somebody wrote to me and asked me whether this is the return to the situation, the tension that went on between the West and Russia in 2014, whether we're back to that. All this will be discussed in the report about the Putin's ultimatum to the U.S. And much more than that, some are predicting World War III, and I'm also going to talk about all this and my own predictions and how they, in fact, are materializing. So that's the first one. The second one is about U.S. elections. It will be about Clinton, of course, and of course Trump and their chances. It will be about the clash of the U.S. elites as it is developing now, and also what to expect after the elections. All these two reports, one is written, another is spoken in the radio show format. It's an interview format with one of my favorite interviewers, Paul. A lot of my readers actually know him from the Time Monk Radio, and he agreed to interview me for that. And so this will be a very special event. That's the U.S. election show. Please go to my site, ladderay.com, or if you know it as ladderay.info, that's the same thing. Go to Earthshift Reports and click on those. There is a nominal donation that is required. Part of one of the reports will be actually free on YouTube. And just go ahead and listen or read those reports. They're very important. These two are very crucial for the understanding of what is happening in the world and what to expect going forward. And we, as usual, go beyond 3D. We go beyond the mundane and the physical, and we discuss it from the perspective that is not just geopolitical, but also higher consciousness perspective. And as usual, I bring in my own intel that you really cannot find anywhere. You might find bits and pieces, but you will not find the full picture. That I have a lot of sources. I reconcile all those sources, and I actually create a full picture out of these disparate little bits and pieces that one might find out from here or there. So these are the main things that are happening, and I think it's very exciting. And I really am excited to bring those reports to you. And of course, always, as always, you can go to Futurist Trendcast, which is my main blog, where everything is advertised. All the links are there. And there are lots of new articles there as well. So Futurist Trendcast, just type it in Google, or go to futuristtrendcast.wordpress.com. Well, these are my announcements.
Thank you, Lana. And please, I encourage the listeners to the Cosmic Switchboard Show, as well as anyone else who happens to come across either your information via your sites or my own, please take the time to go to Lana Ray's websites, because it is a treasure trove of information. Again, Lana comes from a perspective of being from that part of the world, having all the contacts, having all the sources. So this is really a rare opportunity that we must avail ourselves of. One of the most recent articles you wrote, Lana, is an article about spiritual geopolitics, which is the merging of consciousness, of a higher consciousness perspective with geopolitics. Here in the West, too often, people only look at geopolitics from a logical 3D perspective, but from your perspective, that is an incomplete and actually incorrect way of viewing geopolitics. Would you like to elaborate on that?
Yes, geopolitics actually takes its origin in the West, and again, my article goes into the details how geopolitics came to be. The term was coined by a Swedish researcher and scientist. Then the term became very popular in England, in the UK, turn of the 20th century UK, where the empire needed to preserve its position in the world and grow, if it possibly could, any further at that point. There were several theories that were developed. Later, also U.S. participated in the development of all these theories that justify the invasion and colonization of the world. One of the theories was the theory of the island, then the Heartland theory, then there was sea powers versus land powers. And all these theories, they basically clashed, and they seek to bring in a conflict with neighbors or with certain other countries. If, for example, sea powers always were supposed to dominate, therefore, U.S. emphasized the development of its fleet in order to control the oceans and straits. Land powers, of course, the sea powers were the U.S. and the U.K., according to that theory, which is one of the most popular, incidentally, theories in conventional geopolitics. And the land powers were Russia, China, Germany. Other powers were classified as subordinate or as hybrid powers. And, of course, according to that theory, U.S. and U.K. would always come on top because they can dominate the oceans. Well, as we see now, in our day and age, we have moved so far past just the oceans being the main transportation arteries of the world. We have planes, we have, if we're talking about war, we have very destructive missiles that you actually don't need a plane to deliver anymore. When Hiroshima and Nagasaki were bombed first, and that was 1945, you needed a plane to drop those terrible bombs on the people of Japan. And today you don't need anything. You have all these missiles that can be delivered across the globe, and a lot of these missiles nobody can even track, or nobody can, well, the latest Russian inventions, you can't even track those missiles. You cannot, there is no recourse against them. So these whole theories, all these theories based on confrontation, they don't work anymore. They actually really never did. They just encouraged more and more war, more and more hatred of each other. The Heartland theory, another theory that is attributed to the British scientist Mackinder, this theory was popular with Hitler. And based on that theory, he invaded Russia because he was a big fan. Actually, believe it or not, Hitler was a big fan of Britain, everything British. And he adored the Heartland theory, according to which the landmass and resources of Russia, Ukraine, and Central Europe were paramount. According to that, you had to dominate the heartland, which was Russia, Ukraine, and Central Europe, in order to actually dominate the world. So he went ahead and invaded all those territories. Well, we know how that ended for him. There were lots of other possibilities. Vietnam, for example, was invaded based on the domino theory, which was another brainchild of the same one of the geopolitical theories based on confrontation. So I have been trying for several years to write and to explain things, how things work in the world, from a different perspective, from a higher knowledge, from a higher consciousness perspective. And I never actually wrote about this, and recently I finally decided to put all this in writing. The response was very good. People really liked it, and they wanted to hear more. What is spiritual geopolitics? First of all, I think that the old definition of geopolitics as the clash and the constant fight of empires between themselves doesn't work anymore. And so I define geopolitics the science and practice of human and state relations on planet Earth. Yes, it is imperfect. Yes, it is a 3D through 4D construct, but this is the only one we've got. I actually like the term geopolitics. I don't want to throw it out because it actually does define what we want to talk about. Geo is globe, it's the earth, it's land, and politics is relations between large groups of people, or politics also can signify relations between elites and the people as well, of any given nation, any given city, any given territory. So here we're talking about politics in the global sense. So geopolitics as a term makes perfect sense to me. So I don't want to throw out a perfectly good term. Instead, I wanted to clean it up and rebalance it and make it look good and work for the new millennium, for the new reality that we are transitioning into. So I define spiritual geopolitics as a merger between geopolitics, spirituality, and multidimensional consciousness. And this merger is actually a very important merger in order to transform the existing human 3D consciousness of confrontation into the fifth dimensional consciousness of cooperation and unity during this Earth shift. And I talked about the Earth shift last time we spoke, and Earth shift is this new shift, global shift, that is happening on the planet right now, and it is happening in all areas of life. It is not just physical, it is also consciousness shift, it is the shift as far as the power structures go, and it is also a shift from the previous dominance of the West, but not back to the East. It is going to be more evenly distributed around the world. Some call it multipolar world. Well, I'm actually not the biggest fan of this term, but that's the only one everybody knows. But the great balancer, Russia, is presently very busy rebalancing the world away from the West taking that excess power that was ceded to the West erroneously because Russia was too busy fixing the problems of the collapse of the Soviet Union, that extra power that the West was never supposed to have, which represents itself and manifests itself in this world as aggression, as dominance of other cultures. So all this is being slowly rebalanced away from it and given to other places on the planet. So Russia is kind of redistributing it more evenly so that eventually all this becomes a more equitable world. This is what we really, really need to understand, that we all have been living in a very imbalanced world. And a lot of people feel that on many levels. Some feel it with anger, others feel it with denial, others vote with their feet and leave or start protesting. But we actually have to understand that we ourselves, we, the people of the planet, we ceded that control. We gave it away. We can take it back. Well, this is in a nutshell what spiritual geopolitics is. It also is supposed to empower the people. We all are supposed to understand that we are simultaneously sovereign individuals. In other words, we have to stand in our power, in our personal power. We have to be empowered personally first in order then to influence the world. If we are in our power, then the outer world reflects our power. And then that power is reflected back to us. It's a mutual reception. And we are at the very same time as we are sovereign individuals in our own power. We are also individuals of the collective. We are individuals and we're parts of the same collective that exists on the planet. So we influence everything through our all of our actions influence what is happening on the planet. If we are not acting, if we're choosing not to act, that also influences a lot of things. And there are plenty of examples. Like, for example, when there are elections, should you vote or should you not vote? It's everybody's decision. But depending, see, we do have a certain amount of power. You know, if you want to be cynical and say, oh, well, nothing depends from whether I go and vote or not, nothing depends on me, then the result will be as you envisioned it. Nothing really does depend on you if that's how you're seeing it. A great example is Ukraine. So many people in 2014 just stood by and watched how Ukro-Nazis, Ukrainian fascists, took over the country, and they thought it would blow over or Uncle Putin will come and protect them, and he has some kind of secret plan to liberate them all, and a lot of Ukrainians are actually very angry at Russia for not coming and rescuing them from the bad Western, pro-Western government, from the bad people who came to power, but they never wanted to do it themselves. Only several regions in Ukraine actually tried to stand up. Some had more resolution to do that, others less, and we have the results that we have right now. And it's the same everywhere. It's the same in Syria, it's the same in the U.S., it's the same in every single country. So this is in a nutshell what spiritual geopolitics means.
It ties in with something, a concept you developed called quantum calibrations. Could you elaborate on that?
Quantum calibrations, or just simply calibrations, as I call them, of human consciousness, they are a part of my whole Earthshift theory. And spiritual geopolitics falls into the Earthshift theory. Calibrations themselves were first proposed and developed by scientists whose name I very conveniently forget right now. And I actually am using his scale of calibrations And I developed it further. I added new calibrations. I reinvented certain explanations and how all those calibrations work. And I use calibrations a lot broader. Basically, what are the calibrations? Yes, incidentally, people can find out about that if they go on my site, laderay.info, laderay.com, same thing. And if they go to the Earthshift system, under the Earthshift system, there is a drop-down menu and quantum calibrations are right there. So you can look at all the definitions there and the scale of calibrations, complete scale is there. Plus, I have videos, very informative, very good videos that present each calibration and what that means. So on the scale of calibrations, we have we start from zero, which is depth, and we go up the scale all the way to 1,000. We have a large number of values, and they start from zero, which is depth. Then I have several subdivisions, near depth, then deathly shame, then shame. Then after that, we have guilt. And I'm going to just give examples of what else exists. Then there is apathy, which is at 50. After that is grief and despondency. And then we go into fear. Fear at 100 is the first calibration at which these lower values, in lower values below 100, people actually don't want to live. It is the kind of energy where people want to die or kill others. This is, if you go into grief or below that, into shame and guilt, at those levels, oftentimes you get people like terrorists. This is what's happening in Syria. This is what's happening in Ukraine. This is what you have there. Those kinds of calibrations. It's grief and below. Once you get to fear, it is not a nice calibration by any stretch of imagination. But that's already the first calibration at 100 when people actually want to live. And after that, it gets better and better and better. There is desire. After that, there is anger. And anger, incidentally, can be a positive because anger can be very negative. That actually sends you into lower deathly calibrations. But anger can become a positive when you actually need to pull yourself out of the lower deathly calibrations. And once you get to pride, this is the not a positive calibration yet at 175 and above, but it is the calibration where you actually start valuing your life so much, your own well-being, so much that you actually don't want to get into a conflict. Actually, pride is a very interesting calibration, and a lot of politicians, even of global significance, such as Merkel, for example, or John Kerry, calibrate at this level, at 175, 185. This is actually amazing, but a lot of Western politicians tend to calibrate at the level of pride, which is why they actually, when they conduct negotiations, they shy away from conflict, not because they are pacifists, not because their consciousness is high and wonderful and they understand the value of peace. It is because of self-preservation, which is one of the key features of pride, along with things like keeping up with the Joneses. That's typical pride for you. Right there, having like a really great Ferrari and a wonderful McMansion just because your neighbors have it. That's your pride. And after that, we jump to the next level. There's an intermediate level of striving and yearning right above the level of pride. But after that, we jump to the first level of courage. And courage is still a confrontational calibration, but it is the first positive calibration when others' well-being is valued more than your own. This is the level at which heroes calibrate, soldiers, heroes, those who are defenders and protectors of the motherland. They calibrate at that level all the way to 249. And at 250, we get the very first level that is non-confrontational. It is the level of neutrality. And I also call it oftentimes neutrality and friendliness. A friendliness is like the lukewarm friendliness. You'll never be a terrific, like passionate friends with a person who calibrates at that level, but that person will never stab you in the back. That's a guarantee. Once somebody calibrates at 250 and above, that is a guarantee that you can at least know in your heart that that person will never betray you. And the example of that kind of calibration is the ex-president of Brazil, Dilma Rousseff. Well, she would never stab anybody in the back, but she was stabbed in the back. That's the downside, unfortunately, of being in the positive calibration when you're dealing with people in a very low calibrated environment with counterparts that are ready to stab you in the back. After that, we move to the next level, which is a wonderful positive level, is the level of willingness and cooperation. And it's 310. At that, as you see, the scale is numeric, and it actually goes, as I said, all the way to 1,000, which is high enlightenment. But 310 is such a great calibration because at that point, you actually get people really willing to cooperate with each other. A lot of businesses, very successful businesses, calibrate at this level. You actually have to. After that, at 350 and above, we get acceptance, and that's the level of various healers, new age practitioners, people who live in a lot of towns such as Santa Fe, for example, or, you know, progressive towns, perhaps. And then we make another jump. At 400, we get to the level of reason. And some people started maligning reason, I see. It's very interesting, like as if reason is actually a lower category. No, reason is a very high category. It requires, this is the first level, which requires high IQ. You actually cannot have reason because you have to synthesize, analyze and synthesize information at that level, unless you have a pretty high IQ. And I don't mean a sky high IQ, but like relatively high IQ. Education also is one of the attributes of the reason. Scientists, all kinds of philosophers calibrate at this level. Researchers, professors, judges, incidentally. Incidentally, true justice as it should be. I don't mean something like American justice, which calibrates at the level of pride. I mean, true justice calibrates at the level of 400, 410. Voltaire, that's a typical example of the person calibrating at the level of reason. Voltaire and everything he said, all his aphorisms, all his phrases, those catchphrases that we know from Voltaire, they are typical reason. All this, incidentally, is presented in my videos on calibrations. Please go ahead and just watch them. There is a lot of interesting additional information there. So after that, I added some additional levels, and we jumped to the new level. At 480, I added the level of humanity and compassion. And in the original scale, that one did not exist. And at that level, what happens with reason at 400 is that a person can be very sharp, can synthesize information, can be very, very good at everything, but it doesn't mean that that person will have compassion and humanity and understanding of that the world has to be treated gently. Like, for example, all kinds of chemists, biologists, you know, they might torture animals in their labs. They might generate weapons, all kinds of physicists that then will kill people. At the level of 480, which is extremely functional level, very good at synthesizing information, but compassion is added. And so at that point, a person cannot harm anybody or anything on the planet. It's a terrific level. It's very rare, very, very few people or countries or organizations reach that kind of level. And then we make a new jump, and that's a revolutionary jump, and extremely rare on our planet. That's the level of love, which is 500. And this is a wonderful, beautiful vibration at which people love actively. They actually act on their love. And it can be, I don't know, it could be even a surgeon. You can even hurt from love. Like Mother Teresa is a very, very good example of the level of love. Then we make another leap forward to the level of joy at 540, and that's from the original scale. But I add a new level, level of high creation at 580, and that is the level of geniuses from the art, composers, the biggest authors, writers. Like, for example, most of his life, Leo Tolstoy calibrated at 580 and above. Composers, the biggest names like Mozart, Prokofiev, Beethoven, the biggest artists, Michelangelo, for example, and their creations calibrate at 580 up to 600. That's one of the most beautiful, beautiful vibrations on the planet. High creation. This is where the biggest breakthroughs in all areas of human existence that benefit everybody, not harmful ones, not weapons, for example, but really benefiting others. Some of the biggest athletes calibrate at that level. And a very rare instance, probably the only one on the planet, is Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov calibrates at that level too. He's a poet, incidentally. That helps a lot. So after that, we jump, we make another leap to 600, which is the level of peace. The level of peace is beyond what most people can practice and live actively with, because that's the level of monks, that's the level of meditation, that's the level of beautiful nature somewhere very far away from civilization, where it's untouched and very gorgeous and very, very well balanced. It is very, very rare. Thich Nhat Hanh, that's the name that comes to mind, calibrates at 600. That's he is from Vietnam. He's Tibetan Buddhist monk and poet. Then we make another leap to 700, which is what I call, it's my own definition, functional enlightenment. So at 700, it's functional enlightenment. Then we get to 800, 900, and 900 levels, and all the way to 1,000, which will be high enlightenment. A functional enlightenment is when a person is quite enlightened, actually, and hardly can function in this world, but still can function, in fact. It is very, very difficult to live in the 700 and up calibration, and some hang on just to impart their wisdom on the planet so that people could actually learn something that they would not otherwise. And there is an example, Eckhart Tolle is functional enlightenment. He calibrates exactly at 700. It is very, very difficult to function in that state. It is actually very difficult to function in 3D even at the level of 580. No, from personal experience, a lot of things are difficult to do in 3D once you get to certain levels, because you are way too high. You are in those dimensions. You function better in other dimensions, actually. But some people, they actually hang on in order to help others. Once you get past 750 and into 800 and 900, then it is the level of Buddha and Jesus, and basically it is the level of ascension. You really don't hang on. Like, for example, Leo Tolstoy, he calibrated at 910, at the time of his death. In other words, he had to live and function at the level of 580 or 540 most of his life, because that's, it's necessary to be on that level in order to be functional. But when you are about to die, you can afford, you don't need to do much physical, and so you can afford to go into those higher calibrations. And so some people who really are quite enlightened throughout their lives, they can let go of physical manifestations and physical attachments, and then kind of go into the mountains or into the woods and meditate there and actually die in peace. And that's basically how they allow their calibration to reach that level, which is like the Buddha-like, Buddhahood level. Some go to monasteries for that. It's very rough what I'm saying, is that there is a lot more to the story. But in the nutshell, this is how it works. And these calibrations, they are terrific, terrific for determining a lot of things. What I do with them, I don't just calibrate people, I calibrate countries. I go, I can calibrate any object or subject. I can calibrate an event. I also can divide my question into various areas. Like, for example, one of them is personally choose the amount of energy that is available, a person, a country, an object, organization in this earthly existence. And then there is a cosmic side, which I call calibration, the cosmic life force. And that is, in fact, something that is embedded in this incarnation through the cosmos, through the cosmic consciousness. When I calibrate these two values, I actually have a pretty good idea of what anything is. Article that we are discussing, as a matter of fact, it's a different article. If you go on my site, you can see both geopolitics, spiritual geopolitics, and the calibrations there as well. And there are examples of different calibrations. It becomes easier to understand once you get examples. And so when I talk about these things, I usually encourage people to learn how to calibrate, which is done through kinesiological tests. I oftentimes don't even have to do a test. I can just tell the value. I feel it just the way a person or a country or an event presents itself, the energy it sends out. I feel that energy. And so when you try to determine this energy, kinesiologically calibrate, or just determine it if you can feel the energy well enough, then you have a better understanding through my descriptions, which are on the side, of what this is about. Like, for example, I'll just give one example so you understand. We talk about various countries, and we talk about large entities. And so we're going to calibrate the U.S. right now. Okay. So United States right now calibrates at 200 presently at this specific moment. And calibration, as I said, is the cosmic life force, cosmic consciousness that is embedded presently in this realm in the USA. And the chi, which is the earthly life force, calibrates at 180, right. So what we have here is the country actually has the present cosmic life force of 200, which is actually much, much higher than it used to be even a year ago. And I believe this level of courage, that is because a lot of the population is awakening before the elections. U.S. elections are sending this calibration, propelling it higher, making people pay more attention and choose their side. And if you remember, that's the first positive calibration of 200, is the courage, courage to choose, courage to fight for your truth. That's what's happening right now. But the chi is at 180. That's, which is self-preservation and also keeping up with the Joneses. This is where all these debates that they do, they calibrate at 180 and 150, which is anger, and below as well. Sometimes it's even fear. It's actually not pretty. So that's where USA is right now. And I'm just going to calibrate Russia for the sake of an example. And presently at this specific time, cosmic calibration of Russia is 280, which is the level of neutrality and friendliness. And the chi level, Earth's chi level, is 280 as well right now, 280. Well, it depends on the time of day. It depends on certain factors, but I'm calibrating at this particular specific moment. So we have 280, which is friendliness on both sides. Big difference, humongous leap compared to the U.S., as you see. So just, I hope that it's understood what I, from my brief description, and of course, we can always talk about it and people can go and look it up on my site as well.
It makes perfect sense. The way the corporate West operates, inwardly, they operate from the perspective of anger and territorial acquisitiveness. They outwardly project to the subject peoples in their domains the aspect of fear of terrorism, fear of Russia, fear of China. So it's interesting how the scales tip one way or the other, but I'm glad, as you pointed out, Lada, that the U.S., as far as the populace is concerned, is trending in the right direction as far as the quantum calibration scale is concerned. You talked earlier about the life force and the chi of various nations and nation states. Another key article that you wrote in the recent past is about mass migration. What happens if a country gains or loses its life force? And this is a subject that is very topical and trending at the moment because we see the baneful effects of unlimited mass migration in the West. We've seen it in the EU. We're seeing it increasingly in America and other countries. And yet Russia has managed to retain its cultural identity, its cultural cohesiveness. Would you like to talk about and elaborate on the reason why you wrote this article about mass migration? What happens if a country gains or loses its life force?
Yes, this is the latest of my articles, and people can go on futuristtrendcast.wordpress.com. It's right there. It's right on top presently. Well, in several days, there will be something else there, but for now, what I define, again, as I said, I define the life force, the ethereal energy, in other words, through the presence of which we exist in this world, as twofold. I mentioned that before in calibrations, but I'll reiterate. It's cosmic life force and earthly chi. And chi, of course, is Chinese for life force. So I oftentimes collectively call it life force, unless I'm calibrating where I'm actually interested in knowing what is happening cosmically and earthly. So I divide the two because values are usually different. But when we're talking about the life force in general as a cumulative thing, then we can talk about three values, the surge of the life force or the rise of the life force, whichever way you prefer, and then also the stable or stagnant life force, and the loss of the life force. And in this article, I described all three examples, both historically speaking and presently, what is happening today. And just to give a very good historic example, the U.S. Was a great example of a gradual and consistent rise of the life force for quite a while, and it began very, very quietly in the 17th century, you could probably say, or at least 18th century, and then it just gradually grew for two centuries and into the 20th century, where it actually exploded, especially after World War II. But in this millennium, the opposite is happening. Little by little, the U.S., as U.S. empire is waning, is losing its life force. At this point, U.S. is actually in the stagnant life force category. It's stable to stagnant, but primarily stagnant. EU is another example of the stagnant life force at this point. I give in this article the present-day examples of the surge of the life force, and these are there are other countries like that, and of course the situation also changes, but the most sustained surge of the life force is China, which started in 1980s and still going strong, and the reason, of course, is very, very legitimate. The population is very large in China, and it has been held down for centuries. It was not allowed to actually prosper and develop and become more prosperous. And so a lot of people, there are millions and millions of Chinese, actually over a billion probably. Overall, I think the population is 1.8 billion. The numbers are actually understated that Chinese report to the world of how many people they actually have. They might have closer to 2 billion than what they are reporting. But all these people want to achieve something. They want to live better. They want to have upward mobility. They want to have that pride, like, oh, same as Jones's or same as Wang's, right? I want to have the same as this guy has. I want to have the same house. I want to have the same job. I want to have a car or motorcycle or whatever the current desire might be. And all this is pushing the development of the country upward. And China is able to do it right now. So since 1980s, this has been a very steady and very prominent life force gain. In 1980s, we also saw very good examples of the surge of the life force in Asian tigers and in Japan as well. Well, those are no longer in that category. They basically, the life force there is stable, and in the case of Japan, we can probably call it stagnant for the most part. I would say that it's 90% stagnant, but China is continuing to add to its life force. And another example is Russia. And Russia is a very interesting example because in the 90s, Russia was basically a basket case, and the majority of analysts and lay people all thought that Russia would disappear. I spoke to a lot of Russians in the 90s who were quite gloomy or who resigned to the fact that their country is going to be some kind of natural resource colony to the West, that Russia was not capable of anything else. Actually, the doom and gloom was so widespread, just accepted amongst Russians in those days. It was appalling. You wouldn't believe how Russians thought about their own country in those days. That was a typical, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, typical loss of the life force. Russia, in fact, the Russian world in general, which is more than Russia as we know it today. It's also Ukraine, it's Belarus, it's a few other republics that composed the Russian Empire in the 19th, beginning of the 20th century, and then throughout the 20th century, it was the Soviet Union. So Russia is not within its normal borders. It's actually in the diminished capacity right now. Territories that we know as Georgia, Armenia, not to mention, well, Azerbaijan even, the Baltics, Ukraine, Belarus, part of Central Asia, they were a part of Russia for the longest time. And a lot of them were either purchased or were intrinsically Russian territories or were exchanged for some other territory. And in some cases, like in Georgia, Georgia's case or Armenia's case, governments, rulers of those lands begged Russians to accept them as part of the Russian Empire in the 18th century in order to save themselves from the Ottoman Empire or Persian Empire absorption. So all these stories that Russia conquered something or took over something, well, it actually doesn't hold any water historically. And either those who say that are not real historians or they lie through their teeth. But in the 90s, Russia experienced this huge loss of its life force. And at the same time, Russia, as that often happened in history before, became yet again this big donor of its resources, including population, talent, skilled workers, all kinds of athletes, researchers, scientists. I was in that category, incidentally, who all migrated to the West, and they enriched the West. They actually staved off the collapse of certain calamity in the West. The depression was actually postponed by the migration of so many skilled and talented people who created new things, new technologies, new realities, internet, incidentally, not internet itself, but say, if we want to mention some names, is it Google founders? One of them is Russian. It's from that immigration. Sergey Brin, I believe his name is from that immigration wave. His parents brought him when they immigrated in the late 80s or beginning of 90s. They brought him to the U.S. And there are other examples like that. But that's not all. Resources. Russia became the donor of the resources to the West. Very few know about this, and nobody likes to talk about it, including Russians, because it's actually quite embarrassing. But unfortunately, Russia was looted. Russian companies, enterprises, oil, gas, metals. Russia has everything. That's actually one of the richest land on the planet, where resources abound. All that was looted. Out of the was extracted from the Russian lands, from Siberia primarily, and just taken to the West. All that sustained the West. Okay, so it was basically, think about vampire. Just the victim is weakened, and the vampire just sucks the blood out of the weakened victim, while the victim cannot even resist. And that is not all. Soviet people and the Soviet Union, actually for decades, I should say, they were putting together stashes of various natural resources. So Russia had stashed away everything from huge amounts of rare metals to all kinds of ores to gold and silver, to various, and oil, of course, and gas and other natural resources. So all that was sold for nothing, for pennies on the dollar, to the West throughout the 90s. There is an opinion that all that sustained the West and actually postponed what we're seeing now, the slow collapse of the Western model of civilization. If that didn't happen, if what many Russians feel, traitors, did not come to power. I do not consider them traitors. One day we will talk about what really happened, how the Soviet Union collapsed, what happened in the 90s, who those people were, why the collapse of the Soviet Union was in fact necessary. But a lot of Russians consider Yeltsin and Gorbachev traitors. If traitors didn't sell out the country to the West, none of this would have happened, a lot of Russians feel. Unfortunately, I feel that it had to happen. Well, it doesn't make me feel happy about what happened in the 90s. It was a terrible, terrible time. But the loss of life force was such, was so extreme that a lot of people thought the country would not survive. And they were doing celebratory dances in the West, that Russia is finally succumbed. Russia is finally their colony. And there is nobody, there is no more great balancer. They didn't know they were, in fact, afraid of the great balancer. Well, this is my personal term. But in fact, they thought that that's it. You know, they have the world. And then suddenly Putin comes to power. And of course, nothing is sudden. And this is the key premise of my life force theory. Anything that happens in the world is because we make it happen. Okay, we have the power, in other words. I know it sounds like some infomercial maybe, but this is actually the truth. If you forget about infomercials and other things that were told to you somewhere on TV or by some gurus, this is actually the truth. If humans decide not to work or fight or stand up for their truth, for their country, for their beliefs, for their way of life, then the country will disappear. This is a typical loss of life force. So it turned out that Russian life force, as it has to be with the great balancer, is tremendous. An immunity to problems, an immunity to crisis is also tremendous. We know from history that Russia, despite being invaded so many times, despite experiencing humongous problems throughout history, like collapse of the Soviet Union, like World War One and Two, revolution, Napoleon invasion, etc., etc., Russia managed to fight off invaders, liberate plenty of other countries, if necessary, and rebuild and reinvent herself so quickly that it's mind-boggling. Everybody is predicting one day that Russia is finished. Look, in a couple of years, like it's a completely different country. The reason for that, this is a tremendous cosmic life force that is present there. The immunity is great. So when the body is infected with something, when there is life force in the body, it will fight off this infection and illness and will recuperate. So the tremendous life force is present, and Russia can turn around very, very quickly. It's highly unusual. This is the only country on the planet that can do it that quickly, because it is the truly yin-yang, fully balanced entity. It can fall on its yin side to repair the yang side, which is what happened in the 90s or what happened in 1941 after Hitler just invaded Russia. It falls on Siberia, on its yin side, repairs the yang side, the western side, the European side of Russia. And then it's like a springboard. It just like takes that yin, transfers this to the yang, and start and goes on the attack, goes on the offensive at that point. It's a pretty interesting mechanism, and I will be writing about it in my future books, where I will explain everything from start to finish, how this whole thing works. So Russia, with all this tremendous life force, the moment Russia withdrew her life force that it was allowing the West to bleed itself from, that blood that was oozing out of Russia in the 90s is crazy. So the moment it said no more, Putin comes to power and slowly starts like taking back the power of the country. And of course, he's not the only one. There is a whole team of people and support of the population, which is supremely important, which means the life force is there. Life force is alive. People understand what Putin is doing. And the longer they're doing it, the more they take back of their power. And now Russia is close to, not optimal yet, but close to optimal. And simultaneously we see how the U.S. is losing power, which now we understand how correlated the fact that they were able to bleed Russia in the 90s, beginning of the 2000s, and their power, how U.S. maintained its power, how all this is correlated. So these two things will be closely related. U.S. Slowly but surely loses that extra power that it was never supposed to have, while Russia is gaining power at the very same time. We talked about immigration. I do want to touch on that, but people can go ahead and read the full article in which I talk about immigration. This is a big, big problem in the world. And there I also explain how if a country is has lost life force, one of the manifestations will be that the population will be leaving. They will be voting with their feet, and that's how mass migrations happen. So we have countries that are attractive to live in. And why is that? That's because the life force is there. The life force is present. But say for example, people from the Middle East, they leave to Europe. Does that actually mean, let's ask ourselves, does that actually mean that EU actually has a growing or surging life force? No, it does not. This is actually a stable to stagnant life force. That's what Europe has right now. But everything is understood in comparison. Compared to where those people live in the Middle East, where there is war, where there is ISIL, where a lot of people are displaced from their homes, where they don't have social nets which could sustain them if they lose jobs, if they lose homes. So if you compare that to the EU, where, of course, they have tremendous welfare, where they have much higher salaries, where everything is peaceful, of course, it's much better there. But it doesn't mean that the life force there is growing. Compared to how EU was just 10 years ago, this is actually a slightly diminished life force already. So it's basically stagnating to slowly, slowly going down. Same is true for the US, same is true for Canada. Australia is in the same category as well. And Japan, we can also add to that. Basically, what we understand is collective West. And then we also have the phenomenon of Russia. So we know that EU is complaining a lot about migration from the Middle East. Russia, at the very same time, accepted something like 1 million numbers slightly vary, let's say 1 million refugees from Ukraine after the events in Ukraine in 2014 started. They also accepted non-refugees from Ukraine who are either guest workers or who immigrated in order to receive Russian citizenship from Ukraine as well. And the numbers of those who either work or moved permanently or have received already Russian citizenship who are from Ukraine are anywhere between 5 and 7, some say even more, million people. So we actually have huge numbers, huge inflow into Russia from Ukraine. And Russia is not complaining. Russia is managing pretty well. Russia also developed a very, very good system of tracking immigrants. And actually, it's non-invasive. It does not create anxiety. People pay a nominal fee, they pass some light exams, and they receive work permits. So over 11, I believe up to 12 million at this point, up to 12 million immigrants actually live in Russia. Some of them are guest workers, other permanent immigration from various, primarily post-Soviet space countries. And from China as well, there are several million Chinese living in Russia as well, who are either guest workers or who are trying to get permanent residency there. Also, there is an inflow that is increasing of immigration from the West into Russia. And this is growing. So these are indications of the growing life force when there is a lot of immigration. Like, remember, U.S. in the 20th century, big immigration, especially if people are highly educated, if talent is migrating to your country, and if the wealthy are coming in. We also see that happening. Some of the successful former immigrants who immigrated to the West from Russia in the 80s or 90s are coming back now. Some of the wealthy who took the money into offshores in the 90s because they didn't trust the then government, some of them are bringing the money back in. Some of them are coming back into the country. But at the same time, some of the former oligarchs or present oligarchs are leaving as well. Same is true for China. So this is not a one-sided kind of situation, but the overall movement is very large into Russia. And I remember Obama said something to the effect that, oh, Russia is finished, economy is in shatters, nobody wants to live in Russia. Well, that's how much Obama and his advisors know about the world they live in. It's actually scary that the president of the U.S. has such a bad grasp of the situation in the world. In reality, at the time, he said that Russia was number two after the U.S. in immigration, with anywhere between 10 and 12 million immigrants living in the country. Then, for some reason, Germany bypassed, supposedly, Russia for number two position, so Russia is number three in the world. I'm not going to go into that, but that's because of the Middle Eastern immigration, I suppose. So what we have here is the surge of the life force manifests as immigration into the country, and we're talking mass immigration, but also as the rise in infrastructure projects, huge spike in creativity, business activity, and overall the country feels richer. It feels active. It feels like a lot of things are happening in the country. A lot of things, there is a lot of enthusiasm for various things that are going on. There is growth. You can see opportunity. It's palpable in the air. And the actual energy that you perceive in the street is positive, is confident. What is interesting is that a lot of Ukrainians are arriving into Russia from Ukraine, and they all say the same exact thing. They cannot believe, they say, how structured everything is in Russia, how you actually need to observe the laws. They cannot believe how clean everything is. They cannot believe that they, much transportation, public transportation there is there, how comfortable it is, that you don't have to cram yourself into like one little bus, that there are so many buses, there are so many trains, if there is a metro in that specific city where they live, that people actually have this little smiles on their faces, people look confident, and they don't look scared of anything or like they do in Ukraine, apparently, when they walk on the street. There is a sense of confidence in today and in the future. So everything is understood in comparison. Of course, Russians still complain. Russians love to complain. They're complaining less nowadays, thank God, but they had that manner in the 80s and 90s when the country was collapsing, to complain a lot. And the Ukrainians preserved that, so they complain all the time because they never actually grew out of that. But Russians grew out of it a lot, and Russians still complain a little bit. But, of course, compared to Ukrainians, they feel like the happiest people on the planet. And actually, international polls that were done recently, there were several different polls, and they were rating countries by happiness factor. And actually, Russia comes very close to the top. I don't remember all the other countries there, but Russia consistently in different polls, as far as the happiness index goes, ranks near the top. Well, if we're talking about Ukraine, it tends to rank really near the bottom. And that's despite the fact that there was a ruble crisis, that there were sanctions, that there were all these problems with Ukraine, and now the West is attacking Russia and threatening Russia on all fronts. Despite all that, people are actually quite happy. So this is, in a nutshell, how the surge in the life force occurs. And the loss in the life force is something that we see in Ukraine when the population is leaving in droves. In fact, in Ukraine, different polls have different numbers, but anywhere between 30% and 65%, according to some polls, of the population wants to leave the country. They dream about immigrating. They don't want to stay there. There is nothing there for them. See, everything is diminishing. The loss of the life force manifests tangibly in 3D, always, as diminishing. in all spheres of life. It's a dying business, dying trade, dying cultural and social activity. It can manifest in really bad quality of education, zombifying of the population through propaganda, lots of things that are actually look terrible, civil wars, foreign invasion. This is what's happening with countries that lose their life force. Ukraine is a prominent example. Syria is another such prominent example. Of course, we have Libya, Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen. These are other prominent examples of a catastrophic loss of the life force, which result in terrible calamities. And then we have certain things that the country or the population of the country, as collective consciousness of the population, can do when that happens. There is option number one, basically to shrivel up and die slowly or quickly, depending on what the situation warrants. And that could mean invasion by somebody, an absorption by a foreign power. So you stop existing as a cultural and societal entity that you were as a country. Or you can fight if you still have life force, if you have that immunity that is fighting the illness, fighting the infection, then you can fight. This is what's happening in Syria. People do fight for their country against the invaders, basically. This is what's happening in Donbas, in eastern, what is now still eastern Ukraine, but practically separate. People decided not to succumb to that illness of fascism that took over Ukraine, and they're fighting for their independence, for their right to be themselves. So these are the options. If you actually have that inner life force that is still there, then you will fight. You will protect yourself. You will try to change the situation from within and from without. It's like rising like a phoenix out of the ashes. And that's what's happening in the situations that I described. Ukraine at large is basically preferring to shrivel up and die at this point. It's very sad for me to say that because part of my family comes from Ukraine. So it is a very, very sad conclusion that I've come to. And option three, if you have this life force that actually almost abandoned you, you might get a volunteer share of the life force from somebody else. So Russia has done this with Ukraine on many occasions before. Russia is still helping Ukraine. They actually still send them gas at discount prices. It's a complicated story how they get that gas because it goes, it's called the reverse from the EU, but Russia's closing their eyes onto the fact that, in fact, Ukraine is siphoning of Russian gas. It never goes to the EU and then comes back to Ukraine. It actually is siphoned off while in Ukraine, and then it proceeds to the EU. Of course, there are other possibilities, like when somebody donates their life force to you, like, for example, Russia is helping Syria right now, Syrian government, the Syrian population. Well, this is the donation of the life force. A historic example of the donation of the life force was the American Marshall Plan of rebuilding Western Europe after World War II. Well, simultaneously at the same time, the USSR made huge investment and sent talent to help rebuild Eastern Europe, as well as China and some other Asian countries as well. All this was done for geopolitical reasons, of course, after World War II, but to get those countries on their side and keep them in good graces. Both U.S. and USSR had the same idea in mind. But we're leaving aside the geopolitical reasons here. This was the life force sharing. So my hope and my prediction, actually, that the same will happen with Ukraine eventually when this madness leaves Ukraine and this in this Kyiv junta is gone and U.S. is out of Ukraine, then Russia can again share the life force with Ukraine and help rebuild it. And I also think that my prediction is that EU will participate in that rebuilding as well, possibly China also. So this is how all this works. This is the life force theory in very quick details.
Well, thank you, Lana. That was very educational for me, and I'm sure it has been for our listeners. We've reached the end of the first hour, and we're just getting started. In the second hour, Lana Ray will talk about what's going on in Syria, the recent developments there, the U.S. bombing the Syrian army in order to protect its proxy, ISIS, ISIL, Daesh, al-Nusra, al-Qaeda, whatever you want to call it. And Russia had retaliated with several key actions, including the plutonium ultimatum issued by Putin that Lana Ray had alluded to earlier. So we're just getting started. If you believe in what we're doing here at the Cosmic Switchboard, please go to our website, thecosmicswitchboard.com, and subscribe and become a member. And we will be right back at the top of the next hour.
Because this is a frequency war.